This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guests this morning are Annie Leonard and Eric Asadorian. Annie is co-director of the Story of Stuff Project and creator of the film and author of the book, The Story of Stuff. Eric is a senior fellow at World Watch Institute, director of the Transforming Cultures Project, and co-director of World Watch Institute's State of the World 2013, titled Is Sustainability Still Possible? Both Annie and Eric authored chapters in the State of the World 2013. Annie Leonard and Eric Asadorian are here today to discuss what is needed to move from a consumer society to a more sustainable future. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Diane.
Both of you address the issue of consumerism in your work. Remind us of the downsides of consumerism for our society, both environmental and social.
Sure. There are so many, not just kind of the obvious ones of an undermining of the planetary systems that we all depend on for now and future generations, but even day-to-day, time deprivation where we're stuck in traffic more or have less opportunities to engage with our family, obesity. I mean, the U.S. is one of the largest nations in the world, and that's causing major health side effects from diabetes to heart disease and so on. The inequities that are being exacerbated both in worker communities here but also abroad as we try to get as much stuff as possible at a cheapest cost as possible. So there are many.
You know, when we think about consumerism, it's not the same thing as consumption. I mean, of course, we all need to consume some things to live. Consumerism is a particular relationship to consumption where we try to meet our emotional needs, demonstrate our social status through stuff. It's a really unhealthy relationship with stuff. And as Eric said, you know, it's trashing the planet. It's trashing each other. And the biggest irony is we're not even having fun. It's not working. If it was fun, we might want to have a different conversation. We might want to talk about how to prop up this inherently unsustainable system longer. But since it's not even fun, the time is so ripe to figure out a different way to live on this planet and relate to each other.
Would you speak about some of the historical influences that helped create the consumer culture?
Sure. There's a debate whether this kind of a really recent phenomenon in the 1950s after post-World War II and efforts to kind of really reboost the economy globally, or if it really started in the 1700s, where new entrepreneurs suddenly had access to all these new goods and more energy resources and really started experimenting with ways to sell stuff that people don't need, whether that's pottery, door-to-door, which is some of the first kind of consumer sales forces, or new products like coffee and soap, even to that level of kind of exploration of stuff. But if you really look at it, it was the confluence of energy and new marketing, learned those techniques that have really driven us to a level of consumption and a relationship with consumption, as Annie noted, that's completely unhealthy. This idea of $500 billion of marketing every year, that translates to $16,000 every second spent on marketing somewhere around the world, encouraging us to consume more and more and more.
I think it's fascinating to note that it is $16,000 every second, because a lot of people I meet say, isn't it natural? Aren't we just inherently greedy and want to consume more? I say, no, we are being bombarded with messages all the time that are stoking our sense of inadequacy and promising us that we will be more attractive, better loved, more successful if we buy more and more stuff. Imagine, by contrast, if $16,000 every second was spent to convince us to be kind to each other, to convince us to understand and respect the ecological systems that make this planet livable and able to sustain human life. The advertising onslaught really is a driver of this consumerism, and that's why one of the things that I'm most excited to see around the world is people beginning to put limits on their advertisements, you know, declaring some places like schools off limits to advertising. You know, we need to, as a society, say that some places are off limits to this onslaught of commercial messages and reclaim both our physical and our mental landscape from this just relentless messaging.
What would a culture of sustainability look like in terms of resource use and the possession of stuff compared to our culture today in the U.S.?
I have to say, radically different. There's a great table that I've been kind of referencing in State of the World a lot from a chapter of Jenny Moore and William Reese, who was the co-founder of the Ecological Footprint. And it really summarizes what a one-planet way of life will have to look like. And it has three columns, one on what a three-planet lifestyle looks like. And for reference, Americans live a four-planet lifestyle. And in the three-planet world, we're eating 80 kilograms of meat a year. we're driving a massive amount, flying a lot. But if you actually look at what a one-planet lifestyle looks like, it's hard to envision from an American perspective. One example is that the average person owns 0.004 cars. Okay, so if you actually do the math in a population like Seattle or Washington, D.C., similar populations, the 600,000 people that live there would have access to 2,500 cars. So if you add up all the fire trucks and the police cars and the delivery trucks and ambulances and buses, there are no private cars left, maybe a small taxi fleet. So if we're really talking about the scale of change we need to get to a sustainable future, it's a very different kind of world that we'd be living in.
Definitely very different. And there's a lot of concern about what we're going to have to give up. And we are going to have to give up a lot of the material comforts that we have today. But it's important to note that other kinds of comforts and joys could actually increase. I mean, right now, if you do surveys of working parents, pretty much every parent in this country says they don't get enough time with their kid. We all feel constantly time stressed. We take less vacations than our parents' generation. We have fewer friends than our parents' generation. Fewer of us know our next door neighbors. These days, one out of four people, 25% of people in the U.S., say they do not have one friend with whom to talk about personal issues. I mean, talk about deprivation. We are lonely, we are time stressed, we are socially isolated, and we're increasingly unhealthy. In all of those areas, we could see an improvement in life. We can have more time to spend with our friends and family. We can have more time to engage in civic activities, which is really important if we're going to get our government back to be accountable for people again instead of just corporations. There's a lot of things that will be more positive, more relaxed, more joyful if we could scale down our consumption.
And not just if we can, but actually because we do, right? So if we actually lived in a car-free Seattle, where all the streets were just filled with bicycles and pedestrians, while that is shocking and hard to imagine, and how do I get to the grocery store, the infrastructure would start evolving, the culture would start evolving, where you'd have, you know, your neighbors who you now know might be running to the grocery store on their bike car or the equivalent of whatever kind of replaces the car and would be picking things up for you. I mean, there would be a whole different evolution in the culture to support the infrastructure changes that would be happening. So, you know, deprivation goes hand in hand in this conversation when you don't kind of stop and deconstruct how much else would change as the material world would change.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Annie Leonard, co-director of the Story of Stuff Project, and Eric Asadorian, senior fellow at World Watch Institute and co-director of World Watch Institute's State of the World 2013. Our topic is what is needed to move from a consumer society to a more sustainable future. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Let's talk in detail now about how to re-engineer our society for sustainability. How much does making positive changes in our personal life and personal choices contribute to better outcomes for the environment?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because there's a very strong stream in the environmental discourse today focusing on 10 simple things you can do to save the planet. It's actually a book that's called How to Save the Planet Without Leaving Your Desk, sort of implying that minor changes in our shopping habits and minor lifestyle changes will add up to enough to really figure out how to live sustainably on this planet. And I want to give you a two-part message. One part is that those things are important to do. We should, of course, recycle and compost and carry our own bag to the store and avoid bottled water. And when we do shop, we should, of course, buy the least toxic, least exploitative product available. But the second part of the message is that while those are good things to do, those are absolutely not enough to bring about the kind of change that we need. So what my chapter in the book focuses on is, great, do those things. Live as ecologically as possible. But realize that those kinds of actions are not commensurate with the scale of the problem. And one of the reasons is that the bulk of the environmental damage that's out there is not the result of individual choices. Like, take garbage, which is one of my favorite issues. I think it's fascinating to look at how societies produce waste. There is so much focus on recycling and composting and reducing our own waste, which of course we should all do. But if you look at the total amount of waste produced in this country, the waste coming out of our households is only about 3%. So we can do sort of gymnastics, just bend over backwards trying to reduce our own waste, and we're just touching the tip of the iceberg. What we really need to do is not just live responsibly, but then work together as citizens, re-engage in our democratic processes to change rules and policies and government spending priorities and business practices, because those are the places where the decisions are made that cause the bulk of the environmental harm today.
And I'd add, if we really think about how the consumer culture came about, it was the use of key societal institutions, media and marketing, education, governance, business, of course, even traditions. The wedding today is a good example of a ritual gone wild. And so we also have to use those institutions strategically to nurture a new sustainable culture. So the one simple thing I would add to the list of things to do as an individual is not just consume green, not just get civically involved, which I think are both important, but also use the power that you have. So if you're an educator, probably most important thing you could do is use that network, that leadership role, to make the school a paragon of sustainability, whether that's working with other teachers to create a school garden, whether that's to get the toxic food out of the cafeteria and replace it with sustainable local and organic fare, whether that's changing the curriculum in your own classroom and getting other teachers to do the same. Really using that power that you have in your role, in your career, in your community to really push a sustainable culture.
To what extent do small acts at the personal level distract from greater engagement in the political efforts?
There is a huge debate about this, and I think it's a fascinating debate. There's a group of social scientists and economists who've studied this and who've said that small acts are wonderful on-ramps. You start by shopping at Whole Foods and carrying your own bag, and you move up what you call the ladder of engagement. You get more and more involved. So a lot of people think they are a great doorway through which to enter this world of making positive change. There are an equal number of social scientists and economists who've studied it and said that those kinds of small acts not only don't add up to enough in terms of the impact, but that they actually serve as a placebo or a distraction. So the shorthand for this debate is, are they on-ramps or dead ends? And I have interviewed people in these different camps. I have read like crazy. And my conclusion is that it depends. It depends how this information is shared. If the message is, recycle and then you don't have to worry about your waste anymore, that's a dead end. That is a distraction from the real solutions. If the message is recycle and let's work together to get rid of the kinds of packaging that is not recyclable and let's work together to pressure these companies to make their products longer lasting so we don't have to throw them out as fast, then those kinds of individual actions can be an on-ramp to greater engagement. But we certainly can't take that for granted. It's just too easy to check off your list of don't buy bottled water, buy organic, and you think, oh, that's it, my civic duty's done. And we need to keep telling people those are an excellent place to start, but they are a terrible place to stop. Make sure those are your first steps and not your only steps.
Annie, you brought up a great quotation in your chapter, too, that kind of goes back all the way to the abolition movement. Just the big point that, you know, even in the abolition movement, people were so committed to buying, what was it?
Free produce, which means things made without slaves. It was a subgroup of the abolitionist movement that said they will make change by ensuring that they never buy anything that was made with slave labor.
But they put so much of their life energy into that process that they forgot the bigger effort. And so we see that even in the environmental movement today, where people are so obsessed with buying the greenest and they stop there because they exhausted their political energy in that process.
In what ways have companies helped keep the focus of solving environmental problems on individuals rather than making improvements in their products?
Well, lots of companies have figured out that a very effective strategy to deflect attention from them is to focus it on the individuals. And the prime example of this was an advertisement that I saw in my youth, and I hope many of your listeners will remember. It was called the Crying Indian ad, and there was actually an Italian dressed up as a Native American who was kayaking through a river full of garbage. And it was an incredibly emotionally powerful ad. The camera zooms in on a single tear rolling down the fake Native American's face. And if you haven't seen it, go to YouTube and Google Crying Indian ad. It was really a very impactful commercial. At the end of this, the fake Indian is watching a car drive by and they throw a bunch of garbage out the window. And the narrator says, people start pollution. People can stop it. And the point of this ad, it sounds like it was an anti-litter campaign, but the truth is that ad was produced by the companies that made single-use disposable food packaging. It's so ironic. So what they did is they wanted us to focus on the individual act of the people who throw it out the window to make us think it's our responsibility. Whereas in reality, it is not people who started that pollution. It was the huge multinational corporations who decided to make single-serving beverage containers. They were the ones that started the pollution, and they should stop it. But it was a very effective strategy. The term litter bug and lots of these other sort of cartoon characters and other commercials that really focused on the individual action. Now, I want to be clear, I'm all for individual responsibility, but we should not buy it when the companies tell us that the reason there is global warming is that we drove to work instead of rode our bikes, or the reason we are running out of water is that we left the water on while we were brushing our teeth. Of course, be responsible in your household, but the bulk of the impact and the bulk of the potential to make solutions are in the halls of businesses and government.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Annie Leonard, co-director of the Story of Stuff Project, and Eric Asadorian, senior fellow at World Watch Institute, director of the Transforming Cultures Project, and co-director of World Watch Institute's State of the World 2013. Our topic is what is needed to move from a consumer society to a more sustainable future. What do you consider the most promising changes taking place to lead us away from consumerism?
That's a really hard question. I think if you have to pick one, then the power is lost, right? So in my chapter, I'm really talking about all these different institutions. And if you just focus on green burial as a way that traditions are evolving, that doesn't sound powerful enough. But when you look at them in the aggregate, green burial and all the changes going on in schools, the eruption of B corporations, these corporations that are benefit corporations putting social mission over actual profit. If you look at all that, of the social media and social marketing efforts like the Story of Stuff Project and many others, all those together are sowing seeds of a sustainable culture, are using Aikido to kind of push back against this giant corporate and consumerist driving machine. And I don't know if they'll all add up to enough to get us to a sustainable future in time to avert major ecological changes, but they're at least sowing those seeds so that when this consumer model can no longer continue, when the systems break down, when the fossil fuels become so expensive or locked out of the system because policymakers finally realize how disruptive they are, then they'll be there. These new ideas, the ways to bury people, the ways to celebrate with people, the ways to teach children and make businesses that can continue and sustain both the investors and the communities they're part of, those will start to blossom as the cultural vacuum is created around the end of consumerism and replace this consumer model.
I think it's important that you asked about this because there's a lot of really grim data right now about the state of the planet. Every day, if you read any intelligent news or listen to intelligent radio, you will hear new data about melting ice caps and declining water and collapsing fish populations and growing toxic chemicals. I mean, there is so much bad news out there. And for me, the greatest antidote to that, the greatest source of hope and inspiration to keep moving forward is all the solutions that are popping up. And so it's really important to look at those. I sort of do it as my meditation every day as I read about somebody that is doing something to fight back. And the good news is it's all over. It's all over the world people are doing things. One of the trends that gets me most excited is this new resurgence of sharing. All of a sudden, sharing is so popular. It's like it just got invented. It's actually got a new name now. They call it collaborative consumption, formerly known as sharing. And this idea of sharing is exploding in the private sector, in the public sector, and in the nonprofit sector. Just as an example, in my town, the public library system has a tool lending library. So if I need to use a jackhammer, a stud finder, a power drill, anything, I don't need to drive out to Home Depot and buy one for that one single use and then have it clutter up my garage for years. I can just go borrow it for free from the library and then give it back for the next person to use. There's car sharing, there's bike sharing. There's a cool new online platform called Yerdle. It's YERDLE.com, where neighbors put pictures of what they want to share, and then they share it among each other. The reason I'm so excited about sharing is not just because it reduces our overall material use. You know, it increases the effectiveness of each unit of material. If a power drill can be used by 100 families rather than each of us have our own. So there's a material efficiency piece. But also, we have to talk to each other if we're going to share. We have to know each other. Neighbors have to leave their computer screens and go outside and talk to each other to actually hand the item back and forth. And so to me, the community building, social fabric strengthening aspect of sharing is one of the most exciting parts about it. So that's one of the things that keeps me really excited these days is the sharing revolution.
Eric, looking specifically at the environmental movement, you spoke in your chapter, Building an Enduring Environmental Movement in State of the World 2013, about the need to get to a deeper environmentalism. Would you explain?
Sure. I have been part of the movement for, I guess, 13 years and have seen the same things that have been being talked about since the 70s and 80s. I start that chapter with a quote from Peter Berg, who was a well-known environmentalist who, back in the 80s, early 80s, right after some of the best victories in the movement, the Clean Air Act was passed, the Clean Water Act, critiqued the movement, saying, "We have been on the defensive since our beginning. We're fighting a machine that always stays outside of our reach, so we're essentially field medics dressing the different devastation going on." And that is still the model. We're trying to fight off fracking. We're trying to fight off new coal plants being built. We're trying to fight global warming and fight and resist. And we're way outgunned. And we're always on the defensive. And we're a very small community. And we're essentially, as others have critiqued, we're a special interest that is lost among the many other special interests. And we're also completely dependent on the financial sources that are part of the unsustainable capitalist system. If we actually get to a post-growth model, investments will dry up and will be fragile. If systems break down and the consumer model actually breaks down, then again, the nonprofit community is a very fragile community. And so that's just on the kind of working side. But where do we go from there? How do we improve, or how do we make an enduring environmental movement? And I call in that chapter to encourage people to look at movements that have lasted not just 20 years, 50 years, but 2,000 years. Let's look at missionary philosophical movements and learn from them, right? What do? They create a holistic philosophy. They build fellowship and community around a shared understanding of our purpose in the world, understanding of suffering, or what in the religious terms called theodicy, shared values. And they also put those into action. So I wonder why there's no such thing as an ecological clinic where people can actually go and get help that they might not be able to afford because of the inequitable system we live in today and we don't have public health care. But instead of just helping to treat the symptoms, diabetic patient getting insulin, there's also an effort to help pull them out of the consumer culture that has made them ill in the first place, the packaged foods and the toxic way of life that has really push so many of us into an unhealthy state of being. So you know, that can manifest itself so many ways. I mean, a prescription that in exchange for this insulin, one has to contribute to the community for 10 hours in the community garden that's part of the clinic. And then there you're getting outdoor, you're getting time, exercise, you're reconnecting with real food, understanding what that food is rather than thinking that something that comes in a plastic frozen wrap is actual real food. And so you're starting to be pulled out through a very connected community with a shared set of values into a much healthier way of relating to others and to the planet. And that could spread. That could be a model where you're actually mobilizing people around environmental issues in a way that's helping them in the immediate term and building actual long-term political power and community.
What do you see as the biggest blocks in moving from a consumer society to a more sustainable one?
Wow, there's so many. But, you know, the good thing about there being so many problems is that means there's so many ways to intervene. You know, I think one of the most important things that I really hope all of your listeners will get involved in this work is the fact that we have lost our government to the corporations. I mean, the way that our campaign finance works, the way that our government is run these days, corporations have so much more influence in decision making than regular people or the planet, obviously. And so one of the most important things that we all need to do is pitch in some time and effort onto one of the many campaigns that is working to get corporations out of the government. Now, I'm not anti-corporate. I'm not anti-business at all. But I believe corporations and businesses belong in the marketplace, not in the government. So there's some excellent campaigns like Public Citizens Campaign, Free Speech for People, a number of these different coalitions that are working to reduce the influence of corporations in the government. As long as corporations have so much more influence in the decision-making process, it is going to be just incredibly hard for us to move forward an agenda that puts people and the planet first. And, you know, I don't want to give up on the government. A lot of my friends are like, oh, why should I even bother to vote? You know, why should I get involved? Monsanto and Exxon can outdo anything I could do. But the reason we made a government, the reason we created it in the first place, was to solve problems that are too big to solve on an individual level. And we are facing a big problem right now, which is that we're overstressing the planet. And to make change, we've got to reclaim our government from this corporate money-marinated system where the government can once again be accountable to real human needs and work for the well-being of communities and the planet. So that's my number one obstacle, is the undue influence of corporations in our democratic process.
And I'd just add, probably the scale of change that's necessary. We as a collective humanity use 1.5 planets worth of resources, which sounds probably not too hard to fix, right? Well, we can shave off a little bit here and there and get back to one planet. But countries like the U.S. are living four planet lifestyles. So their future for a sustainable one has to be significant economic degrowth, a total reorienting of our pro-growth culture and economic dreams. And that process of really getting there is going to be challenging. I mean, even mainstream organizations like the International Energy Agency are saying to have just a 50-50 chance of keeping climate change to the non-catastrophic level of 2 degrees or less, we would have to keep 2/3 of all known fossil fuel reserves in the ground. 2/3. So if we're actually using that last 1/3 strategically to get a renewable energy infrastructure and not to prop up the consumer society, we're still talking about a future with much less energy, a major transition from this consumer way of life we have. And it's hard. It's so alien that it's going to be hard to kind of really mobilize around, especially when there's so much corporate power pushing in the very opposite direction.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd like to invite them to get involved in helping to build a better future. You know, someone recently asked me, isn't it hard work trying to turn things around, trying to transform our economy to be sustainable and just? That is a really big task. And someone said, isn't it hard? I said, yeah, you know, it's hard, but you know what would be intolerable? What would be even worse is not trying. We all know that there's huge problems out there. And just ignoring it or tuning it out, I believe it slowly chips away at our soul. It chips away at our spirit. Getting involved hopefully will make a difference, and also it's a lot more fun. You meet great people. You get to live out your values in your day-to-day life. There are so many organizations and ways to get involved, so think about something that excites you. Search on the internet for an organization working that. Call them up. Join. Get involved. It is a really great way to spend your life.
I would second that. I would say get involved, and especially in ways that really utilize your power. So again, if you're a business person, figure out ways to really make your business more sustainable. And if you're a pastor in a local church, start integrating green themes and looking at creation care in ways that really motivate more people, so your adherents. And just recognize that the individual's role in all of this is not changing their shopping bag, but really mobilizing for much broader change.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Diane.
You were just listening to Annie Leonard, co-director of the Story of Stuff Project, and Eric Asadorian, senior fellow at World Watch Institute, director of the Transforming Cultures Project, and co-director of World Watch Institute's State of the World 2013. For more information, check on the web at worldwatch.org and storyofstuff.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.